So I've met probably 90% of the people, 95-98% of the people in here. I'm with Columbia PD. I'm the polygraph examiner with Columbia. I have been there 28 years. I'll start my 29th year in July. So long time. I am also now currently the president of PLEA. Some of you guys may be familiar with that. We're going to talk just for a couple minutes about PLEA, and then we will move on into TDA. We're going to talk about TDA and federal ESS for sure, and we'll see how many people are still here after lunch to talk about training new examiners. We've got a little slideshow on that. So I've talked to a lot of the guys in here about PLEA before and kind of what PLEA is. Chaz, come on in. So PLEA was started by NCCA, I believe, about 15, 17 years ago, and it's the Polygraph Law Enforcement Accreditation Program. And the main goal is for us as a polygraph group to be kind of all doing the same thing. And that's where we all know we fail at that. We all use different cut scores and different TDA and different formats and different things, and this is the way our agency does it. And I learned from this agency, so that's the way we do it. And one of the goals of PLEA is to kind of put everybody under one SOP, where we all use the same TDA, we all use the same cut scores, we all use the same scoring formats, we all use the same testing formats. And the goal would be to kind of unify our programs and to all do what is based in research. One of the goals, or I guess one of the advantages of the federal government, is that there's just one polygraph school for the federal government, and all the 28 or 29 law enforcement agencies that have polygraphs in the federal government all go to the same school. So when they come out, the FBI, the Secret Service, the ATF, the CIA, they all use the same formats, the same cut scores, the same TDA, it's all the same. And so back in the day, Jim Hall, Bill Gary, a lot of those guys, Rusty Manley, all these guys that we know over at NCCA, came up with this PLEA accreditation program. And essentially, it provides local law enforcement agencies with a standard SOP. And that SOP is just designed so that we're using the best standards and practices. It's not anything wild, it's not anything crazy, it's probably most of what we learn in polygraph school. It is much like CALEA, kind of, if your agency is CALEA, or with CALEA. We would just encourage folks to have a good policy, for the policy to cover lots of things that probably our policies don't cover. How many tests a day you can run, 100% QC, how much training you need in a year to maintain your own agency training objectives. And everything that PLEA recommends is all based in research, molded after what the federal government does. So if you decide to come into the PLEA program, it's free. You would be essentially running your program no different than the FBI, the Secret Service, or anybody else. It would all be standardized. All right, there's an accreditation process that we do go through. It's all managed by local examiners from across the country. So we have guys from LAPD, we have folks from TBI, we have folks from Virginia State Police, Pennsylvania State Police, all involved in the PLEA program. And if you decide to come in, we'll get you teamed up with somebody, get your policy up to date, get your programs up to date, any formats that you're not sure about. There are approved formats. I had somebody tell me the last time we were at Escape, they're like, we didn't join PLEA because you can't use a Bi-Zone. That's wild. That's not real life, right? Bi-Zone is our bread and butter. That's what we use for 99% of our criminal tests. There is a guide. Does anybody here, and we'll talk about this when we talk about TDA, does anybody here's agency have a TDA guide? So that when you are scoring charts, you and another examiner disagree on something, how do you come to a resolution on that? What book do you open up and say, no, that's not what cardio is, that's not what EDA is, this is what it's supposed to look like? Do you have a TDA guide or a manual? Okay, do you use your polygraph book?
Just the
NCCA. Okay, yeah, NCCA TDA. All right, does anybody keep that like out on their desk? And that if you come across something you're not sure how to score, we'll refer to the TDA manual. Well, that is kind of what plea is about. Argue with the book. We talk about that all the time. If you guys send me a chart and I score it, and I send you back a score sheet, and you're like, hey, man, what is this? I said, well, it doesn't fit one of the rules of the homeostasis exceptions, or this was early, or this was late, or this cardio was rolling. I'm going to say, go to page 5, line 2, paragraph 7, and read that paragraph and tell me what it says. And that's how we score charts. It shouldn't just be on vibes, right? We don't want to score charts on vibes. Well, I just feel like that looked good to me, so I'm going to put a plus or a minus on it, right? So that's kind of one of the things that we want to do with PLEA is kind of standardize everything so that we all kind of have the same rules that we follow. Once you go through an accreditation, you get your policy straight, you get your formats right, you get everything standardized. We go through an accreditation process, and that process will be renewed every 3 years, kind of like CALEA does every 3 years. Now they're doing it every year, right? Is CALEA doing like a third of your agency every year? I think that's the way they're doing ours now. So it would be every 3 years you go through a reaccreditation process, and essentially you just send in, depending on how many examiners you have, a handful of charts, some applicants, some criminal charts, and we look through those. We just make sure you're still following your guidelines and your standards. You got 100% QC on everything, and you're reaccredited for another 3 years. All right, it's completely voluntary for both members and agencies seeking accreditation. Doesn't cost you a thing. It improves the quality of your polygraph support. So currently, because I'm a one-man shop, Tennessee Bureau of Investigations does all of my QCs. They have a full-time QC. They have a pretty good-sized polygraph program. They have a full-time QC. I have a guy that just, that's all he does. He's their chief examiner, and he just scores charts. So it was very easy for him to take on one more person, and he scores all my charts. So it is nice to have that network of people to go to if you want to have some QC if you're a one-man shop, or even if you're a two-man shop and you need a tiebreaker somewhere. That's what PLEA is there for. All right. A lot of what I find when we get new agencies that come in to PLEA is we get to help them write their policies. And so there are a lot of chiefs and sheriffs out there that don't understand that running 3 or 4 polygraphs in a day is tough on your brain. And there's no policies that prevent that. Well, this is where PLEA comes in, where we can say 2 a day is about all you need to do. That's max, and that shouldn't be every day all the time. 2 a day should be about all you do. If you have a morning test and that person has some trouble and you have to retest them, and then you get a little lunch and you have an afternoon test and that person has a little trouble and you have to retest them, that's 4 series in a day. That's plenty. All right, technically that's only two tests, but that's 4 series in a day. You should have a policy that covers that. If your policy doesn't have anything in it that covers training, how many hours of training you need in a year or every other year, then this is a good opportunity to put that policy in place so that when it comes time for AAPPs or APAs or SCAPES or Tri-States or senior examiner courses or anything like that you want to go to, you can say, I have to keep my accreditation, I got to go to this training. So it's a real good way to put that stuff in your policy. Okay, the quality assurance program at the federal level was established in 1996. Senior examiner courses were developed, and it really was a mix-up. Has anybody ever taken back in the day, probably now that NCCA has new directors and new supervision, they're not offering as much to us as they used to. Did anybody take the traveling 40-hour senior examiner courses back then? Yeah, I mean, I know I did back then. You used to go to NCCA in Columbia and take those. They're not really offering that as much anymore. If you look on their training calendar, occasionally there'll be something on there that locals can go to, but you do have to call and get permission. They got to run your background and do all kinds of stuff before you go. But PLEA adopted that 40-hour senior examiner course, and the federal government still pays for that. And so we used to get 4 a year, we're getting 2 typically this year, and I'm gonna put the dates out now while I've got it on my brain. We're gonna teach one in Las Vegas this year. That one is gonna be the end of August into September. I'll give you the exact dates. August 31st through September 4, we're gonna be teaching in Las Vegas. It is free. You just have to get yourself there, and your per diem and your flight and all that. The training is free. It's a 40-hour senior examiner course, and it is all of polygraph school basically condensed into a week except for anatomy, physiology, and history. But we go through TEA, we go through all the formats, we go through cut scores, we go through seven position, federal ESS. And then we're going to do another one.
June 8th through the 12th.
Okay, June 8th through the 12th in Pennsylvania. And so that will do one East Coast one and one West Coast one. So if you go to the NCTC website, they should be on the website here in the next month or so. You can sign up through there. Please sign up. Those are great classes. I know Chaz came to Las Vegas a couple years ago. We held one in Charleston about 5 or 6 years ago. It was a pretty long time ago. We did Beaufort 2 years ago. So we'd love to come back to Beaufort again and do an East Coast one again maybe next year. Yes, sir?
Where?
It's at the PSP. Should be hosting that, but we'll put that together at the Pennsylvania State Police headquarters, if I'm not mistaken. I've never taught that one before, but I may teach that one this year, so I'll let you know for sure.
Can you repeat those dates? I apologize.
Yes, of course. I put them in the group chats. Let me just go to that.
Pennsylvania, June 8th through the 12th.
Yep, Brian's got them.
Las Vegas, August 31st. Thank
you. Yep, those are 40-hour classes. Go to NCTC's website here soon, and you should be able to just put senior polygraph examiner in the search bar, and it should pull those up. Has anybody taken NCTC classes before? They offer all kinds of different stuff. Yeah. They offer drug classes, interview interrogation classes. It's all funded by the federal government. Really, really good classes. And it's mostly volunteers, so we don't get paid to do that. We just volunteer our time and teach those classes. So they are not for profit or anything like that. Okay. Talk about that. All right. You'll have a mentor if you decide to come into the program. We'd love to have you come into the program. We'll get you a mentor assigned to get you through your accreditation process. We'll get you inspected. It's a pretty easy and painless process. Nobody's going to tell you that you have a terrible polygraph program or anything like that. We just provide kind of how we got through it. I've mentored other agencies before to get them through it. A lot of times you'd be surprised. It doesn't take much. Most of us are doing probably 95% of what PLEA recommends. The biggest things that most people are not going to like is there's no R&I in PLEA. So if you're an R&I program, there's no R&I. You can't run R&I. So that's probably the biggest part. And the second part to that is 100% QC. I know that's tough for a lot of folks. But it should be 100% QC every test. Typically what we will do, if you're interested, is we make it real easy. We give you a copy-paste letter that you put in your letterhead. It will come from your chief or sheriff to us, asking to be involved into the PLEA process. And then we get you assigned to a mentor. Then we start going through your policy. We start looking at some of your charts. We make some recommended changes, if any are needed. We do a small inspection, and you're ready to go, and you're accredited. It is really not that difficult. Once you're in, we will then use you guys to help teach the senior examiner schools. You can probably go and watch a couple and maybe teach a little bit. And then as you get more comfortable, you can teach more and more. You get to travel all over the country. It's one of the cooler parts of PLEA, to travel all over the country and teach these senior examiner courses. It is a lot of fun. We usually send 3 instructors at a time, and we have a good time doing that. Additionally, you get involved with a network of other examiners who can help you do QC. You can bounce stuff off of them. You can call somebody and say, hey, this is this case I've got going on. Or if you have a cold case or you have a suspect in another state, this is probably one of the coolest things that I've been able to do is I have a suspect in another state, and I call our PLEA representatives there, and I have them run the test for us. And I know that if they run the test and it's a buy zone or it's a zone or it's an MGQT or whatever they're going to run, it's going to be the same way that I run it. It's going to be the same cut scores. It's going to be the same TDA. And I can trust that when they run the test, it'll be a solid test, right? And that's a great part of the process. All right, we're going to review your testing formats, your QC procedures, put some procedures in place if they're not already there. We'll discuss continuing education in your policy. We'll look at a random sample of exams, and we'll suggest some changes to implement in order to fall under the standards. Preparing you for your inspection, and there's no time limit. I mean, there's groups that have taken 2 years to get through the inspection process because they're busy. A lot of us have other things that we do on top of polygraph, and so we get that. All right. We will also offer you the opportunity to link you up with another agency. If you need QC help, we can get you linked up with somebody else. Maybe there's another one-man shop out there like myself or somebody else that can help you out with QCs. All right, and we recommend to the plea board that your agency is ready for inspection. Okay. Talked about most of this stuff. Cost of it is free, doesn't cost you anything. Most of us now have access to OneDrive or evidence.com or whatever, and we can upload all that stuff in. Everything can get emailed back and forth. Prior to OneDrive and those things, we were having to snail mail it because sometimes you couldn't pack but one or two charts into an email and send it before everybody's spam filter would go crazy. And so now we've kind of gotten all that worked out where we can pretty much do everything through OneDrive folder. We can create a OneDrive folder. You can dump everything in there, and then when we're done with that, we destroy it all. Some benefits. You get protection of the department, especially in screening if you're accredited. You get sued or something like that, you'll have the plea board that can come in and testify to you running things by the book, by the best standards. Ensure that the polygraph managers establish the criteria of the program, not that your HR or the captain of investigations or somebody like that who's not a polygraph examiner is telling you how many tests a day you need to do, what formats you need to use, what your cut scores need to look like. It helps you follow good established procedures. And you can always say, we would lose our accreditation if we do this dumb thing. When your chief or sheriff comes to you and says, hey, we need you to do this dumb thing, you're going to say, well, I can do it. But we may lose our accreditation for it. It may cost us our accreditation. That's if they come to you and say, I need you to run 5 tests a day, or I need you to run a victim that is a CSC victim, or I need you to do something like that that you're not supposed to do. Then you can always fall back on that's going to violate our policy. These are the standard formats that we approve. 3-position, 7-position, federal ESS, we're going to talk about that today. Those are the scoring formats. We do concealed information test, directed lie comparison test, all the MGQTs. MGQTs cover version 1, version 2. A LEPID is just an MGQT. We have too many names for things. It should just be an MGQT. We should drop the word LEPID. Air Force MGQT version 1, version 2, by zone, and those are the approved formats there that are backed in research, right? That's 99% of what we already use anyway. Nobody's probably using too much other stuff than these. Anybody here use a Utah? Anybody a Utah fan? I'm not an anti-Utah, but we have a zone already. If you want to use Utah, it is not approved in plea. We're talking about approving it, but really nobody on the east side of the country uses Utah very much. The further you go west, the more Utah becomes popular. All right, test question constructions, countermeasures, authorization to conduct exams, pre-test procedures, data collection, post-test procedures, polygraph instrumentation, TDA cut scores, those will all be standardized among all programs. We'll all be doing the same thing if you come in two plea. All right, there's some accredited agencies there. Any questions about plea? I just want to go through that real fast, and then we had some stragglers that were coming in. If you do, please contact me. I would love to get you guys into the polygraph, the plea program. If you're a private examiner, it's going to be hard for you to do that for your agency. Mm-hmm. Unless you're kind of like retired and come back and they don't care, they'll let you get there. Their agency accredited through plea. But we'd love to have you. Please, I'll make sure everybody has my contact information before we go today. We need people to take over. At some point, I'm going to be done. And somebody else needs to take over. Yes. Yes. All right. So I'm ready for tomatoes to be thrown at me for sure. We're going to talk about TDA. All right. Because we are attached, because plea is attached to NCCA, this TDA that you're about to get is the same that they are teaching at NCCA. And if anybody's not familiar with NCCA, that's the polygraph school at Fort Jackson in Columbia. Now, this will be exactly the same. So if you have been to another polygraph school somewhere else and they don't teach federal TDA, this may be different than what you're used to. Also, I have learned that there is a school in Atlanta that is no longer teaching federal TDA by the book. They have skewed from that a little bit. It is not the same. So, if you're sending new examiners down to Atlanta, be prepared for them to come back and it not be federal TDA. All right? So, when the slide pops up that you don't recognize, and you have recently gone to the school down there in the last year or two, let me know. Let's talk about it. And that's an interesting discussion that we could probably have amongst ourselves here at some point. Oh, I do have an announcement. I almost forgot it. Make sure I say it right. I've got it on email here. Myself, Nate Brooks, and Brian Godfrey have an announcement that we are in the process under Clemson University of obtaining an accreditation from the APA to start a polygraph school. So I don't know how long that's going to take or what that's going to look like, but we're pretty excited about that. Our first class that is on the calendar is looking to be summer of 2027. Between now and then, we are going to offer some continued education immediately. Hopefully that'll be up in the next 90 days on the Clemson website, but it'll be under Clemson University. So this will be something new that has not happened before. We're not going to be a for-profit school or anything like that. And we're hoping to get that up and running, and the campus will be in Greenville, probably not at that actual the Clemson school. They'll have like a satellite school in Greenville County. So, having said that, keep us in mind here in the future for some polygraph school needs and or continued education needs. We will probably start teaching a lot of the same senior examiner class stuff that PLE teaches. We'll probably start offering that through Clemson's umbrella. So I am not a Clemson fan. It is going to sting for me to flip through PowerPoints with Clemson tiger paws and orange and stuff like that on there. I'm definitely not going to wear a Clemson shirt. That's a no for me. I will not have anything like that on my email signature. That's a deal breaker for me. So anyway, I'm excited to tell the group that. We're really hopeful that that'll work. I know we have a lot of obstacles ahead of us to get that done, but we're looking forward to it.
Congratulations.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, yeah. So we'll see how it goes. All right. TDA. It's a great day for TDA. Let's talk about that a little bit. So, TDA, does anybody, I guess we knew we were coming in for TDA, and I'll tell everybody like I tell applicants or examinees, if there is a question that pops up when the slide comes up, please ask it. Don't just sit on it. If I go three or four more slides and then you ask the question, my brain has already moved on to the next set of slides. I've went through this yesterday. This is the same TDA we teach at the senior examiner courses, so it's not dumbed down, it's not shortened. It's going to take us a while to get through it. There's 100 and something slides in here, and this is going to be all of TDA. One of the important things when we talk about TDA is knowing where we were to where we are today. All right. Anybody go to polygraph school, say go to polygraph school pre-98. Okay. There were a lot of diagnostic features.
You're tired.
Right? There was a lot.
Yeah.
There was a lot of diagnostic features, right? So I think it's important to know where we came from to where we are today. All right. So some of the things that were made over the years and here in 2006 to where we are today is kind of what we're going to be looking at. So they got the terminology together. I think we could still do a little better with some terminology. We still have a lot of psychological sets versus salience. My biggest pet peeve is how many different names we have for one format. An MGQT versus a LEPIT versus an MGQT version 1 version, I mean, it is all an MGQT, right? So I struggle with that a little bit. So we're going to talk a little bit about polygraph terminology and utilizing test data analysis that is supported and replicated through research, not vibes, right? So we're going to look at actual TDA that comes from research. In the late 1980s, Dr. William Yankee initiated the effort to adapt polygraph terminology to the field of psychophysiology, and that changed the curriculum over at NCCA. In the late 1990s, there were 23 diagnostic features in the late 1990s. When it went from 30-something to 23, I don't have the year on that. But it used to be 23 diagnostic features that were valid in detecting deception. That's a lot. Can you imagine, and I guess you guys did, having a QC when you send a chart to somebody else, and they've got to look at 23 diagnostic features and come up with the same score that you came up with? I can imagine there were a lot of arguments about, well, I don't see it doing this, or I don't see the upward staircases, or the all the various things, the PVCs, and all the different things that you guys used to score. I'm sure it became difficult. Inter examiner reliability was probably very low. And we're probably getting much better now at all getting the same score on QCs because we're looking at a lot less criteria. All right. So there's a study completed in 2000. And that essentially took our NUMOs to 12 diagnostic features. 12 diagnostic features in just the NUMOs, right? That is a ton. But respiration line length was a viable alternative to those 12 diagnostic features. EDA amplitude was the best performing feature. Cardiovascular was the phasic response. Again, just amplitude was the most significant feature. All right. As a result of this study, NCCA deleted three diagnostic features of the respiratory waveform, which was apnea blocking at the top, right? We know that to be a countermeasure. Kind of today is what we teach that. Loss of baseline, that's just where the NUMOs are chugging along and they just go down, right? That was scoring criteria. Cardiovascular waveform, decrease in baseline, that's just parasympathetic response where we're just chugging along and it just goes down for some reason. It takes a dip. That used to be scoring criteria. And in 2001, that left 20 diagnostic features. Does that sound about right, Dave?
Yep.
Pretty close, okay. All right, the APL study mentioned that RLL was kind of king with NUMOs. Everybody know what RLL is? It's just the different distance of the line length, right? We take suppression and we straighten it out into a line. The shorter that line is, the better the response. Okay, it's visually stretching that response into a straight line and then evaluating that from response to response. Now, there are other TDA models out there that say, you know, NUMOs can only last 10 seconds or can only last 12 seconds. So you can only score it for so long. NCCA teaches to score it until the response is over. So if it's four cycles of suppression, we score the four cycles. If it's three, we score three. If it's 20, it's probably countermeasures, right? But we score it until the end of the response. All right, in RLL, the shorter line length signifies more intense or significant response, and that would be a sign of numeric value. Suppressed breathing and decrease in cyclic rate will always have shorter line length in homeostasis. That is pretty standard, right? So we take a couple of cycles here, straighten it out, it looks like homeostasis, or a slowed cycle there and straighten it out, it's going to be shorter. So that's what we're talking about with RLL. An objective procedure for quantifying respiration patterns, which was in a study, that's an old study, 1982, it's just evaluating a channel of data, so linear measurements of a waveform over time. Has anybody used a planimeter? Did y'all have planimeters back in the day? Did you do analog charts at any time?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And so y'all didn't have any type of a tool or anything that y'all would use to score NUMOs or stretch them out or anything? Okay. All right. Back in 1988, there was some additional studying done out of Utah. Still found RLL to be the most diagnostic feature for NUMOs. We're not learning anything new here, but just multiple studies are telling us that RLL is king when it comes to NUMOs. And this is what I was talking about earlier. There's some other TDA formats out there that say, Tim says, you know, you can only score NUMOs for 15 seconds, or Kircher says you can only score it for 10. NCCA says you score it till it's over, right? So wherever it starts to wherever it ends, that's where you put the value. And if you're scoring two NUMOs against each other, If one's 5 seconds of response and one's 8 seconds of response, you know the 8 seconds of response is going to get the value. All right, then 2002, 2003, Don Crapole, I was hoping he would be here today, but I guess he's probably at AAPP, and Dr. Stu Center over at NCCA, looked back at those remaining 20 diagnostic features and figured out how many of those could be validated in research. And this is where most of us that went to polygraph school ended up with a defensible 12, right? Their exhaustive review indicated that 12 diagnostic features could be supported and replicated in research. So, for pneumos, we're talking about apnea suppression, progressive decrease in amplitude, and decrease in rate and change in IE. And there's only one non-RLL feature, which is temporary baseline arousal, right? Temporary baseline arousal is on its last leg. I think it's probably going to be removed here pretty soon from the TDA manuals. I don't know that it's going to live much longer from what I'm hearing. So, and the truth is we don't see baseline arousal a ton, right? A couple times a year we may see some baseline arousal on a test, right? So we got down to the 6 features of pneumos. We got down to 3 EDA responses. These are the standard ones that we should have all learned in polygraph school: amplitude, complexity, and duration. All right, and then cardiovascular, we'll have 3 as well: baseline arousal, duration, and decrease in rate. Has anybody ever scored a decrease in rate in the cardio? I don't know that I ever have. Bill Gary told me the way that you think about it is the heart starts beating harder, not necessarily slower, and that pump just takes a little longer to pump a little harder. It's probably hard for the naked eye to see, but it is still on the books for response. So 6, 3, and 3 there, that gives us 12 defensible features. Does anybody use anything else other than the 12 that we just talked about? It's okay if you do, I'd love to hear about it. What school taught it? Nope. Okay, all right. Okay, so after that last review of TDA, the presentation was made in 2006 by Don Crapole, and it was approved. 2006 NCCA Curriculum Review Committee approved those 12 diagnostic features, and anybody that went to polygraph school post-2006 should have learned that. Right? That's what most of us learned in polygraph school. Anybody learn anything different? Pretty much everybody either went to the Pennsylvania school or the Atlanta school here, or I know Brian went to NCCA, you went to NCCA, you went to
Argon Bright,
which is now the Atlanta school. Right, okay. Anybody else go to any other schools besides Pennsylvania or Atlanta? Any of the Florida school folks in here? Pam Shaw school, any of those? Okay. All right. So some of the terminology we're going to talk about: homeostasis, pre-stimulus baseline, which is just tonic level, stimulus onset, stimulus response onset. We're going to talk a little bit about the row. That's probably one of the biggest things that Atlanta is teaching different, is that the row is different than what NCCA teaches. Response, recovery, artifact, latency, and analysis spot. All right. So homeostasis is what we all know to just be your state of equilibrium, right? That is what we're looking for going into a question. We want to have some homeostasis. We want the cardio to be non-responsive. We want the EDA to be pretty flat, not labile, jumpy EDA. We want the pneumos to be trucking along pretty good. We don't want any deep breaths or swallows or anything like that. We're looking for all the 3 swim lanes there to be in order before we ask a question. If we are not in homeostasis when the scoreable question is asked, then most of the time that data cannot be considered a response, right? We're not going to ask a question in the middle of garbage, try to look at garbage and put numbers on it. Okay, tonic level is just a pre-stimulus baseline, very similar to homeostasis. It's the level of physiological activity just prior to the stimulus onset. So it's what the chart looks like just before you push the enter button or the space bar to ask the question. All right, stimulus onset is asking a question. Response onset is when the examinee responds to the stimulus, and then the row. So we will talk a little bit about the road today for Pneumos, EA, and Cardio. Does anybody use any other channels besides EA, Cardio, and Pneumos? Is there some other channel that we're using?
We've got a Plismograph. We're utilizing that. Some of the research on that. Of course, we're not technically scoring it, but it is a very good clue when you have a change in your EEA.
Okay.
Your PLE response is pretty damn strong.
Okay.
So that's something to look at.
So yeah. So it's interesting. There's a lot of folks that use it, don't score it, they don't necessarily put numbers on it. NCCA did a very long, exhaustive research on it, found that it provided almost no numerical scoring data that helped come to a conclusive call. I think if I remember right, it was like a half a point for every 15 charts or something, or 15 tests or something like that. So what they did is they ran it on zero, just ran the, they didn't tell the students what it was, stuck it on the finger, put the sensitivity on zero, you know, and at NCCA, you run 50 tests before you graduate there, so they would get all 50 of those tests run with the PLE. They would go back and turn it up later and look at the data, found that it didn't provide enough numerical value to add it in. So it has not been approved by the federal government. PLE hasn't approved it yet. A lot of PLE groups use it, they just don't score it. They put it on the finger, they like to look at it. One of the issues they had was that the computer has to score it. It's difficult to see sometimes, and if you get on the stand, you never want to say, well, the computer said there was value there, so we put a plus or a minus on it. So PLE is it may turn into something, but it looks like the federal government has given up on it. They're not moving forward with it anymore.
When was their last review on that you were talking about?
They just finished that up probably within the last year or two.
Oh, did?
Yeah. And I don't think they're even putting it on the students anymore. I think they're finished with it. They got a couple thousand charts with it like that, and just didn't find that it had enough value to tell everybody to buy one. All right, so pretty much everything we're going to talk about today is going to be Pneumos, EDA, and Cardio. Okay, physiological arousal to the applied stimulus, which is response. Okay, when we ask the question and we see the response, that's pretty straightforward there. We have phasic responses that look two different ways. They can either respond and come back down, right? It just responds and kind of comes right back down to the pre-stimulus baseline, or it responds and just creates a new baseline, right? Both of those are phasic responses. It doesn't have to necessarily come back down for it to be a response. All right, so we have response. Can everybody see that? I tried to turn whites down a little bit. I know some of these poly charts are gonna be in white. I've tried to replace a lot of these poly charts with real life charts so that they're a little easier to see, but these are computer generated charts here. We can see the response at the cardio, the EA there. All right, recovery is a deviation in e-tracing, which is the recovery side of response, right? It's the compensatory action after response, which is just returning to homeostasis. An artifact or any other form of excessive noise, obviously we want to look out for that. Okay, there's the same chart with just the recovery side of the responses there. All right. Artifacts. It's a change in physiological patterns not attributed to the applied stimulus. So it is something that happens in between the chart, or in between the questions, rather. It's a swallow. It's a movement, it's a biting of the tongue, it's a countermeasure. There's a lot of different types of things that we would consider to be artifacts that we're not going to score. We're going to circle slash, hopefully, a swallow, a clear of the throat, a yawn. They just start talking during the test. They just have some of a question they want to ask you. Somebody hears a door slam on the outside of the room. If your office is right next to the lab and they're shooting guns in the lab, and maybe they're going to hear gunfire in the background, something like that, that would be an artifact. Lots of different types of artifacts. Got to look out for those. We're going to try to circle slash those. Also, maybe in the form of purposeful non-cooperation, always be on the lookout for countermeasures and PNCs. Okay, latency is the period of time from the stimulus onset, from the time that the word comes out of your mouth to the time that the response occurs. And that's different for everybody. So that is when you say the word, did you do the bad thing? And they start to respond. That is that period of time in between those two things happening is the latency. Latency should be pretty consistent for each examinee. It shouldn't be 2 seconds in one place and 14 seconds in another place, right? So it should be pretty similar. Some responses may occur within or outside the row. You may see different latency periods with different channels, right? But each individual physiological parameter, individuals are all different. That's why it's really important to look globally across your charts before you score them. I know in some programs, you can just open up all the charts at once, scroll through all three or four of them at one time. You can look back and forth at them, see what their latency looks like, see what their physiology looks like. Take a good look at that before you start putting numbers on it. All right, same chart again. You can see the latency there, how long it takes that person to respond in the cardio and in the EDA. It's pretty quick. All right, analysis spot. In comparison tests, analysis spot consists of the relevant question and then typically the bracketed comparison questions on either side, right? And there, how many analysis spots will be totally dependent on the type of test that you're running, whether it's a bi-zone, a zone, a two-question MGQT, three or four-question MGQT. There will be various amounts of analysis spots. And then you're going to have some MGQTs where you can put relevance together, right? Like version 2 MGQTs, which is probably what most people run if they run some sort of a MGQT for their screening test. You may put two relevance together, and the comparisons on either side of that will go to both relevance. All right. We talked about this a little bit. Preliminary steps to consider before assigning values. Making sure that you look at your data. Making sure you're looking for deep breaths, you're looking for movements in the movement sensor, you're looking for movements in the arm sensors, the foot sensors, whatever sensors that you have. Does anybody have the jaw sensor that they use? I've seen that, it's pretty cool. I'm sure there's probably a lot of people biting tongues that we miss. So take a look at your physiology, take a look at all your data before you start putting numbers on it. All right, we all learned this in school. NUBOs are the what channel? Effector channel, right? It's the easiest one to kind of mess with all the data is to mess with your NUBOs, whether it's suppressing, going into a question, whether it's taking some deeper breaths, whether it's slowing the rate of suppression, whether it is increasing the rate of suppression, increasing the rate of inhalation, exhalation, you're going to see that manipulate and or change the other channels, right? So be super careful when we're looking at NUMOs across charts. All right, so one of the good things about looking at an ACQT, hopefully we're all running ACQTs every time we do a chart or every time we do a test, that we are looking at that and we're making lots of decisions before we run in going to chart one. So we're looking at our ACQT. Ideally, it should be easy on them. There's no stress on them on an ACQT. You should be able to get a pretty good look at their physiology and figure out what you need to do. Do I need to move the cardio cuff from the arm to the forearm? Do I need to put some alcohol on some wipes and wipe their finger plates off? Do I need to adjust the NUMOs? Do I need to go to silent answer? We make all those decisions, hopefully during ACQT, and we can get better charts. Okay, we're going to definitely discuss the exceptions to homeostasis. Does anybody not know what exceptions to homeostasis are or are real familiar with exceptions to homeostasis? That's one of the things that Atlanta's not teaching anymore, is exceptions to homeostasis. And if you've been to the polygraph school there in the last 3 or 4 years, you may have never heard of exceptions to homeostasis, which is tough. That's tough. All right. Is there a question? No? All right. Excessive noise on a signal of interest is inherently problematic, maybe an artifact. A lot of times you can look at the EDA and it tells the story. You get a real active labile EDA during the ACQT. I'll almost always ask them before chart one, what's going on in your brain? What are you thinking about? Is there a question? Do you have some sort of thing that's stuck on your brain that you're worried about? Is there something happening? Because active EDA is probably going to tell them. Artifacts, lingering responses, they have secondary, third, fourth responses in between, questions, all things to look at. Today when we talk, if we say an artifact affects two of three channels, so we're going to talk about that today. If we get a deep breath and the deep breath pulls up the EDA, you cannot use the cardio. Two of the three channels are lost, we lose that question altogether. Okay? That is something also I don't know that is being taught. And even if that cardio looks great, looks perfect, we've already lost the other two channels. So we just don't have a lot of confidence in the cardio. And vice versa, if there's a flex in the arm, and the flex in the arm looks like it makes the EDA do something, but we have these nice little apnea or nice little suppression in the pneumos, we've already lost two of three. So we're gonna circle slash that particular question. Okay, any artifact that impacts the pneumos should be scrutinized. We talked about this, the pneumos, the effector channel. Definitely got ahead of myself there. All right, a significant artifact, an extremely deep breath, an extended yawn that affects the pneumos will almost always render the other channels not scorable. We know that. That is not anything new. All right, response timeliness is also a critical part. We're going to talk about what the row is today. There's going to be a slide on here that everybody's going to throw a tomato at me for sure, but we're going to explain it. All right, let's talk about chart division settings. If you are a QC and somebody is sending you charts and you have to spend the first minute of the chart lining up your pneumos, lining up your EDA, lining up your cardio, getting the EDA is all the way off the page, you're having to reduce it down, the cardio is coming out of its swim lane, the pneumos are all over the place. If I'm a QC and you send me that, I'm probably going to say, you fix it and send it back to me. I don't want to spend the next 5 minutes trying to clean up the charts before I score them. So, as you're going into your chart, this is what is recommended, 2 to 4 chart divisions for your pneumos, which is a 1/2 inch to 1 inch. 4 to 8 chart divisions of your EDA, which is 1 inch to 2 inches. And your cardio should be about 2 to 4 chart divisions, which is a 1/2 inch, which is pretty small. That's hard to see unless you have a big screen, but about 1 inch on your cardio, right? In the federal government, if you send a test like that to QC, they don't even look at it. They're not going to adjust your pneumos. They're not going to adjust your EDA. They're not going to adjust your cardio. They're going to send it back to you and tell you either fix it or retest it. When you're looking at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tests, we don't have time, nobody has time, to go back and fix what charts look like before they start scoring them. So, when you're training new examiners, this is our goal here. This is what we want the charts to look like, size-wise.
Sure.
Yes, sir.
So, I know you use that stuff, right?
Yep.
I have a 5,000, he's got a 6. It looks normal on his, but it will never look normal on me.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because the instruments, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know how that works.
So, like,
yeah.
Because I'll see it on his computer, it'll be perfect, and when I open up, it's all jet.
Yeah, I don't know how that works. Yeah.
I messed him up before I sent him to him.
There you go. Just to make it hard on him. That's what people do to me. They're like, hey, look at this. I can make the EDA go 14 chart divisions off the screen.
So, I do know that, at least for us, because we have different instruments,
yeah.
It appears differently on our.
Okay.
Are you talking specifically the EDA?
So the whole thing, all of them will look like what he's talking about. Like he'll send it to me, and like I have like flat lines, but he doesn't have flat lines at the same setting. So like let's just say it's on like 0.8 for the EDA. He's got a nice rise and fall. I've got a flat line, and I got to turn mine up to like 4 to get the same picture he gets. Even though it's the same software, but it's a different instrument.
Get an Axiton. Yeah. All right. That's a good point. That's a good point. Hopefully your QC has the same.
That might be unique for us. But
yeah. That's interesting.
And now there's a 7 out. So.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. All right. So we talk about artifacts. Somebody clears the throat, takes a deep breath, swallow, yawn. Put some chart notations on there. Make sure your QC knows what you're doing. Tell a story with your chart notations, right? If you're a one-man shop and you're sending a test to somebody else and they're trying to guess at what you did, what decisions you made, what you scored, what you didn't score, The chart notations really help that. NCCA talks about telling the story with your charts, and that is chart markings, chart notes, whatever it is you have to do, so that whoever's looking at your test knows, you know, that was an arm flex, or that was a deep breath, or that was a clearing of the throat, and I've marked it as such, and I'm not going to score it. Okay, we're talking about new modes. The respiratory waveform consists of an inspiration, expiration, inhale cycles, INE cycles. Tons of research on that. Does anybody not score new modes? Just on a criminal test, I'm just going to ignore them. I'm going to look for deep breaths. If I don't see any deep breaths, it's just a circle for everything. I mean, you should be putting some numbers on it. You should be mindful of it, but it's one of our three channels, right? So I score it. Another thing that when I was looking back through this, expiration occurs passively by the natural elasticity of the lung tissue. That's interesting. You don't have to push the air out. You just relax and the air goes out. So when you're looking at somebody's pneumo and you see the exhale cycle is long and kind of jagged throughout the chart, they are consciously slowing themselves down. The only thing you have to do to exhale is just nothing. You get your inhale to the top and then you relax and the air just comes out. So you're looking for nice triangles, upside down triangles there, that are going across the chart. And that is just something to look at when you're looking at pneumos and if whether or not somebody's messing with you, whether the pneumos are not the quality they should be. Look at that exhalation cycle and see if they aren't slowing it down and you see some little vibrations kind of where you can see their heartbeat and various things where they are trying to slow down their exhale cycle. All right, what is considered a timely response in the respiratory tracing? Without Brian, who can tell me what is timely for pneumos? Man, somebody try.
Onset window.
Okay, what is the response onset window for pneumos?
From the moment you start talking until 5 seconds after they answer.
That is what Atlanta is teaching, and that is incorrect. All right, so response onset window is the row. Response onset window for each respiration channel, which there are two, is from stimulus onset to one cycle after the answer. The first cycle after the answer. Right? If you wait for 5 seconds, I have seen charts where 5 seconds after the answer is 14 seconds from the time the question was asked. There is no way that a pneumo response should start 13, 14 seconds after the question was asked. That means the EDA has already gone up and come back down and hit homeostasis. The cardio has already gone up, come back down and hit homeostasis. And now you're seeing suppression. Or now you're seeing an apnea. That's too late. That is going to be taught as a countermeasure in most polygraph schools at NCCA. All right. So it is, this is one of the biggest differences. I don't know where Atlanta got off track or some of the other schools got off track. But it's first cycle after the answer, right? So that means they got the answer, and if that very next cycle something doesn't happen, it's too late. Doesn't matter if you get beautiful pneumos, suppression, right after that, it is late. Okay, right?
Correct.
Okay, all right. No tomatoes, that's why I was waiting on tomatoes on that one right there. Okay, all right. For respiratory, for RLL, we're talking about apnea, decrease in amplitude, which is suppression. Progressive decrease in amplitude. Is there a difference? Is suppression just suppression? Right? Do we really need to name it progressive decrease versus just decrease? Not really, but we do. Okay? On federally assessed, we don't. We just call it suppression. But these are the things that we're looking at that are all RLL. Decrease in rate. Inhalation, exhalation, IDE ratio change, suppression, and apnea. Apnea only at the bottom. No apneas at the top, no sideways apneas, only apnea at the bottom, right? At the top, it's called blocking holding. That's been eliminated. We call that a countermeasure now, right? Okay. One non-RLL feature is temporary baseline arousal. Probably not going to live much longer. Probably on its deathbed, but it's still there. Okay, RLL features to be considered is just a temporary increase in baseline. I think we talked about that. If RLL evaluation method does not apply, then you have the one norm RLL feature. Okay. It is considered diagnostic of deception, and a temporary increase in baseline is said to occur when the amplitude of the respiration cycle troughs represent the point of maximum exhalation temporarily increases. That's where the bottom comes up and the top kind of follows it like a little rainbow, and then it comes back down. Okay? That's kind of, in an ideal situation, what we're looking at, right? It's where the trough there starts to go higher. The trough gets a little higher, the trough gets a little higher, and then it goes back down to where it was. So it's just a little bump in the baseline for two or three or four cycles, right? The more cycles you get, the better your confidence is that it was probably a pretty good response. One cycle of something is nothing, right? And really, the way pneumos are being taught now, two cycles of something is really nothing, right? Most folks are wanting three cycles before we do anything to have some pretty good confidence in it, because most of the time, two cycles is probably an answer distortion and one more cycle, right? So we really want to get maybe an answer distortion and two more cycles. All right, temporary increase in baseline there. Diagnostic. Back in the day, the loss of baseline was diagnostic, right? So that on the right-hand side used to be response. So that would have been a zero back in the day, right? Today, that's going to be a plus, right? If one compares spot and analysis spot is RLL and the other one's not RLL, RLL always wins, right? RLL beats baseline arousal all the time. It always takes precedent over the non-RLL feature. Okay, so here's an example of that. We have three, now again, these are polycharts. You have three cycles of suppression, and then one, two, three cycles of baseline arousal. Which one wins? C4 to R5. We're gonna give it a plus, right? All right, we're always gonna let RLL, is always gonna beat out baseline arousal. Okay, in scoring non-RLL responses, if you have a non-RLL to a non-RLL, which is going to just be two baseline arousals, then you're just looking at the degree or the duration of those two before you pick which one wins, right? So it'll be 11 seconds versus 15 seconds, or however many cycles, and that's how you're going to evaluate that, right? So that's going to be a minus one. Probably not going to see a ton of this on your charts, but you might. You need to know which one wins. Okay. Temporary increase in baseline, most of the time, the way we see it, actually becomes suppression, right? So we have a temporary increase in baseline, but we also have the amplitude change of those cycles. So it becomes suppression. We see that a lot, where just the bottom maybe raises a little bit, but the top kind of stays the same. We would just score that as suppression. Anybody disagree with that? Okay. All right. So here we are with baseline arousal and suppression at C4. And at R5, we just have baseline arousal. So where does the value go? C4 or R5?
C4.
C4, yeah, for sure. Plus one. All right. Respiratory changes may be considered responses when they occur in a timely manner to a stimulus that has been applied. So when we ask the question, there's no swallows, there's no movements, there's no deep breaths, there's no clearing of the throat, everything looks pretty good. If we're scoring our charts from the top down, the very first thing we look at is the pneumos. We don't see any deep breaths, we don't see anything that is gonna affect everything else, then we start scoring everything below it, right? No excessive noise on the signal of interest. Okay, so, here we go. Response onset window. First cycle after the answer. So we see the answer, we see the question, and then the response starts right there, first cycle after. So is that going to be timely?
Yeah,
I think so. Agreed. All right, let's talk a little bit about apnea. Apnea is king, right? We see apnea, but we don't want it to be too good. We need to have a reasonable amount of apnea. 12, 13, 14, 15 seconds of apnea is too much. is way too much. Where we're going to see it is 3-4 seconds, maybe a 5-second apnea. If it's at a relevant, you're less worried that it's countermeasures. You see an 8 or 9 second apnea to comparison, probably not, right? It's too easy to replicate. It refers to the temporary cessation of the respiratory cycle at the bottom. Some forms of apnea are considered diagnostic of deception, while others are not. So at the top, we're not going to say that that's diagnostic. Apnea is considered the ultimate manifestation of respiratory suppression. We love apneas. When apnea occurs at the top of the inspiration cycle, it's considered not diagnostic, more likely behavioral, so probably a countermeasure. The following respiratory features could not be supported by research and were eliminated from the curriculum. So we talked about these a little bit earlier. So we used to score that. Dave, y'all used to score that, right? That was scorable features. All right, apnea holding. So that's a little bit of a Bart Simpson there at C3 there. We have like little three little cycles at the top right there. A little Bart Simpson at the top. Not a diagnostic feature. Loss of baseline, where we just went south a little bit. We're trucking along pretty good at 1C1. In between 1C1 and 1R1, we just lose baseline. That used to be a diagnostic feature you put numbers on. And depending on who trains you, they may still want you to put numbers on that, right? Increase in amplitude used to be a diagnostic feature. So just a couple of deeper breaths from homeostasis, we would put numbers on that back in the day, pre-2006. We were putting numbers on that. So what happens if we take three bigger, deeper breaths right at our answer? What's probably going to happen to the cardio and the EDA? We're probably going to pull it up a little bit, right? So we were giving people credit for countermeasures. Okay, let's talk about this one. Is this diagnostic?
Yes.
Okay. It's a good little, it's reasonable, right? That's about 2.5 seconds. I think we'd all look at that and say that's reasonable. Okay. 1, 2, it's about 4 seconds there. Pretty reasonable. Starting to get on the edge of looking too good, but we'd probably still put numbers on that. If it was a relevant question, we're for sure going to score it, right?
Yeah.
If it's a comparison, we're starting to look at it. I don't know. How many times did we see this in the chart? If we see this on one chart, these are both comparisons. That's C3, the first comparison, and that's C6, the second comparison. Probably not, right? How many times are you going to see apnea twice on one chart, right? And back to back. If it's irrelevant, they get it, right? They get it if it's irrelevant. It's a minus. But if it's a comparison, let's be mindful of that. That's kind of the law of inequalities right there with the relevance. They mess up and screw up if they're irrelevant. You get that minus. All right. Some more diagnostic here. We got a little bit of an apnea, or you can call that two cycles of slowing of the rate, right? The bottom one looks a lot better than the top one. I'd probably give that bottom one a value. All right. Is this one diagnostic? Okay, all right, this is a good one here. That's a good one. There's the end of the first cycle after the answer. So anything to the right of that is late. I sent this chart to NCCA and said, give me the official answer on this from their QAP. Late respiration cycle is over at the bottom of the cycle. So right there at the bottom, right where that red line is, that is where that cycle ends. Anything beyond that is late. Now, if we're using 5 seconds from the answer, we're scoring that. The problem is, from the very beginning of the question all the way to here is about 12 seconds. There is no reason why we should be waiting 12 seconds to respond in a pneumo. Probably the EDA is already bottomed back out, the cardio is already on the way back down, and now we're starting to see a little pneumo here. All right, that was a countermeasure. But sometimes when I show this, and I show it as a relevant question, people are like, no, that's late. But when I show it as a comparison, people are like, Nah, let's put a plus on that. Right? Because people, you want people to pass. Right? We want to scoot them across the line. Get them to pass. And it's just interesting. Sometimes I'll show it as irrelevant. They're like, ah, score it. Oh, I mean, I'm sorry. Sorry, it's late. If it's irrelevant, we're going to score it. All right. So I'm going to throw that one at me. Thought everybody's going to throw tomatoes at me for that one. All right. First cycle after the answer is as long as we can go out. Yes, sir.
So the first cycle was suppressed on red. And then it went into an out on the top. So would you just say that still it hasn't returned to homeostasis, it's a continuation of your response?
No. That cycle is over right there.
So then you're not scoring it until the response ends, though. You're only scoring, how can you...
One cycle of something is nothing.
Well, you have suppression in the apnea, so it's not, it's a continuing response.
It's just one cycle. So if you want to say that that is... if you want to say that that is a response, it's just one cycle. One cycle.
Right, but that's what I'm asking. How can you ever say something's a response? You can only, unless they just respond during the question, if you can't continue it after the first cycle.
Right. It has to start in this cycle. If this cycle is not apnea, now if there would have been a second cycle of suppression or a third cycle beyond that, we can say, yeah, it started here. But because it's apnea, apnea is not one cycle of suppression.
But apnea is a suppression. It's like you already said, it's the ultimate form of suppression.
It is.
I don't get it.
If apnea occurs, it has to occur right here inside of what would be the first cycle after the answer.
You could argue that there is suppression in the top pneumo.
Right, you could, but it's one cycle. Right. I knew this one was going to be a good one.
Well,
that's
why I put
the slide in there.
I guess the way, you know, it's been 6 years for me, but
yeah.
For everybody I've ever done, if there is a response within the beginning and then it continues on, you go until it goes back to homeostasis. So, like, if that first one wasn't suppressed, I would very much be on the same side of you saying that.
Yeah, like the bottom pneuma.
So I'd be like, yeah, it's just a... it's a late response,
right?
But when you're starting a response, now, if you had all three charts, and like you said, it went up, down, then they did that, then it went up and down.
So one of the things that's interesting is this: the exhalation right here with the answer is almost a full chart division lower than this. So if you add that chart division back to the top, if you're just looking at the amplitude here, this cycle and this cycle are probably an eighth of a cycle, eighth of a quarter, eighth of a chart division difference. That makes sense? I don't know if you can see my red line here.
It looks like on the bottom.
Yeah, so right here, if you look at from here to here, that's two and almost a half. That's two and about three quarters. So it's really only...
Right.
So that's what I was saying. If it's irrelevant, you're like, oh yeah, we score that, right? All right. So decrease in amplitude may be exhibited, which is really just suppression, and we'll see it in different ways. You can see it as a progressive decrease where each cycle continuously gets smaller. You can see it where all the cycles are about the same for four in a row, where all the amplitudes are about the same, where they have gotten smaller. Or you can see it in the opposite way where it gets real small and it works its way back up to what homeostasis was. All of those are suppression. Okay? Any way that the amplitude decreases, so you see all three of them there are about the same size, or they do a staircase down. Suppression is suppression. You could flip the bottom one around backwards, where it starts low and works its way back up to homeostasis. That would also just be suppression. Right? Where they are smaller than homeostasis. Okay. So, 2C3 there at the bottom, pretty good little three cycles there. Give that a plus. Anybody disagree with that? Those are pretty easy to see. Replaced a lot of these poly charts, trying to do real charts. All right, three cycles there at the top and the bottom. Those look pretty good, pretty reasonable. All right. See anything there? Bottom C6, maybe? Doesn't look too bad. Two or three cycles there. Just got one there, the laser distortion four. Not much else going on there. All right. Progressive increase in amplitude. If you ever did any tests with Dennis, Dennis loves some upper staircases, right? Dennis would force you to put numbers on that. Gotta score upper staircases. Anybody's been around long enough to do tests with Bob Antonelli, he also liked upper staircases. He would take his clipboard and lay it on the chart and show you how those are increasing, right? Progressively. Upper staircase. Right, Caitlin?
Traumatic.
Yeah, yeah. That was a good time.
That
was a good time.
Can't talk bad about Dennis.
He's
not here.
No, of course not. I'm not talking bad. Definitely not talking bad. Dennis is my friend. All right. Increase in rate. One of the things that they teach in NCCA, nowhere do you ever see an increased or a sped up respiratory rate to be any type of attachment to deception. Anytime you see a sped up rate like that, we're gonna call that countermeasures, right? Where they're trucking along here at 12 or 13 breaths a minute, and all of a sudden we're gonna go to 20 breaths a minute there for 15 or 20 seconds straight. They are just, that's a poorly executed countermeasure, is all it is. Not diagnostic, used to be. All right, so then we have another one where we go inhale, we have an upward staircase, and then back down to homeostasis. Those were also diagnostic features back in the day.
Dennis would afford that one.
Oh yeah, for sure. Because he's gonna say this back half is suppression, right? After it makes it to the top and it comes back down on the way back down to homeostasis, that's suppression. All right. We'll go about 5 more minutes, take a break. And get through pneumos here. All right, IE ratio change, probably one of the easier to see. It kind of jumps off the page at you, right? That is where the inhalation cycle that occurs during homeostasis, we're assessing the rate. It's a three-way comparison of responses of the relevant question, comparison question, and then across the data. So you're gonna look at the relevant, look at the comparison, and then you're just gonna look in between the questions and see what their rate looks like. So it's where they just stretch it out there a little bit. And it can look two different ways, all right? Slowing the rate there at the top or IDE ratio change at the bottom. Both are kind of slowing the rate. Be real careful of the bottom one. We'll see that a lot just where people are trying to slow their exhale during their test. And you'll see that throughout the charts. So it should be a change from homeostasis where they really slow down those rates. All right. So, tough to see, but on the bottom at C4 there, if you look at the bottom, and you see it, if you look at the tops of the pneumos there, you can see how close they are together. And then you can see where they kind of slow down for a couple of cycles at C4. It's about 3 cycles of slowing of the rate there. Those are hard to find. It took me a while to find some of those in charts, but that was a pretty good one. All right. Decrease in rate can also just be a double apnea, right? Or just slowing of the rate for 2 cycles there. First cycle after the answer. All right, they're not all pretty, for sure. And if it's at a comparison, always be suspicious of it. But for the purposes of PowerPoints here, we're gonna look at C6 there and give that a plus. Looks a little suspicious to me, but for the purpose of this, we're gonna plus that. All right, one cycle of something is nothing principle. When assigning values to respiratory waveform, examiners typically want to see some response pattern or consistency. So we're not gonna look at one cycle of something and put a plus or minus on it. 2, we're probably not doing that much anymore either. We're probably looking for 3. That's probably what we're looking for. Anything less than that, let's be reluctant to assign numbers to it. I know a lot of There's a lot of folks that you can push a test in one direction or the other by really putting a lot of numbers on pneumos where you're having to kind of squint at it to get a number out of it. All right, so one cycle there or something is just probably an answer distortion, especially if it's right on top of the answer. Right, one cycle of something is nothing. All right, beat that dead horse. All right, exceptions to timeliness within the response within the row. So there are exceptions to the first cycle after the answer, but you better see it in every response at pretty much every question on the series of charts, right? If they are a late responder, like this guy here is, super late cardio, super late EDA, then the pneumo can probably be assessed if it is late as well. But you should be able to articulate that I saw that at most of the places on the chart, right? I've looked at all three or all four charts, and this guy is responding 5, 6. I've never seen this. This is a polyscore chart, but if I had to guess, that's probably some sort of medication where it's just slow. It's just slow to respond. But if you see that in all the charts, you don't want to go through and put zeros on everything. If we see lots of late responses outside the row, and it's consistent throughout the charts, okay to put numbers on it, but be careful doing that. All right. There's one exception to homeostasis with pneumos, and that is where we get a deep breath, either just before we've asked the question or while we're asking the question, but then we get a couple of cycles there after that deep breath or deeper breath that go right back to homeostasis, and it does not appear to have pulled up the cardio or the EDA. We can go ahead and score through that. We haven't lost homeostasis if we have a deeper breath. Now, I'm not saying if they take a breath that goes all the way off the chart and it's 4 times the size of the previous breath, I'm saying if it's reasonable, maybe 50% bigger or double the size, and it's just that one cycle, and then we get a couple of cycles after that deep breath or deeper breath of homeostasis, then we apply the question, then they answer it, and then they respond, probably okay to score that. That is straight out of TDA manual. Yes, sir?
My examinee yesterday was taking deep breaths as I was asking the question.
Yeah.
It was just one deep breath, but everything else was pretty cool after that.
Did you go to silent answer?
No.
Yeah. If it's chart one, and as soon as I get it in chart one, I like to tell them, hey man, you probably don't even realize you're doing this, but you're taking a deep breath every time you answer the question. We're going to swap over to silent answer. Just do a nice easy head nod for your answer. See if that changes. If it continues to happen, he's messing with you. Yeah. Yep. He's trying to, because y'all run an R&I, he's trying to get all his relevance to be high, right? If you lie to all the relevance in R&I, you pass test, because they're all the same, right? All the comparisons are the same, all the cardio is the same, all the EA is the same. So you just got to lie to all of them. Yeah, yep. All right. What is the only manual chart notation that we should be putting on a chart? Manual means after the chart is over. The only thing we should go back and put on the chart, unless we had something crazy happen that you just don't have a button for and you need to go back and write it later. A deep breath, right, is really the only thing we should be going back and putting on a chart. Suggest you manually mark the DBs later and not during the chart. And why is that? If you send me a chart with a DB on it, what am I going to do? I'm probably just going to skip over it, right? What if the DB didn't hurt them? But you marked it DB, but it didn't really cause the cardio to do anything, didn't really cause the EDA to do anything, and it was reasonable, but you put a DB on it. As a QC, what am I supposed to do? Does that mean you didn't score it, or does that mean you did score it but marked it DB? We're probably going to be on the phone, hey man, what'd you do with this DB? So I would suggest wait till the end of the chart or wait till your series is over and go back and look at it and make a decision as to whether or not it was a DB. Because as soon as you put a DB on it, most QCs are going to be like, all right, I'm not looking at this. Here's an example of that. R4 there is a DB. But does C6 beat it? On the EDA? Does C3 of the cardio beat it? Yeah. Right, this is a version 2 MGUT, so you can both comparisons go to both relevance there. If you marked R4 as a DB, then we are taking points away from them because C3's cardio is either a 0 or a plus, and the EDA is definitely going to be a plus, right? So my point is, if you mark R4 as a DB, as the chart is going, I might not even look at it anymore. I might just circle slash it when they could have gotten positive numbers on that at the comparison, because both comparisons are bigger. Does that make sense to everybody? It's just a tool. It's just something to think about. If you want to go back later and say, yeah, I think that was a DB, I don't love it, because let's say it pulled R4 up real high on the cardio, it pulled the EEA up real high, and we're not going to score that. But just wait. Just wait to go back and put that DB mark on there. All right, let's take a break, and we'll get into EEA.